Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hi everyone, I'm Tora from Manchester and you're listening to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything. And my question this week is, what was the one piece of artwork, be it music, film, visual art, that influenced where you are right now in terms of your creativity? Okay, here comes the show. And don't forget, question everything.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Dame Baptiste Questions Everything, a podcast with myself, comedian and writer, and occasional actor Dame Baptiste, my producer friend Howard Cohen, aka The Hizzer.
Hello.
And a mix of very special guests pose the questions that need to be asked. And we are talking everything from...
We are talking everything from Tora from Manchester's question, what is the piece of artwork that had the most influence on you? Phew, that's a...
It's a really good question.
It's a great question. Thank you very much. Tough gig, though. Tough gig to pick one, right?
Yeah, really tough one. A really tough one. I don't know if I can even get it down to one.
I'd go for Reservoir Dogs. I'm going to go Reservoir Dogs because I think at a very young age, the dialogue and the way the people in that film talked made me think completely differently about how I really liked it sounding like people were real in whatever they were doing. So that had a big impact. That's a good choice.
I'd say it would probably be either Public Enemies, A Texan Nation of Millions. I'd say it would be Nas's album, It Was Written, sophomore album.
I thought you were going to say Nas.
Yeah,
because I know you well enough.
Yeah, because I heard It Was Written before Illmatic, and the song Take It in Blood, I think, is like one of the best examples I said of like poetry I've ever heard and like stream of consciousness. And I think for me, it showed me that you can, you know, coming from the environment I came from, you can still make poetry and art and make it immersive. So I'd say, yeah.
Good choice.
Great choices question.
And great question. Listeners, tell us what you think. And suffice to say, on this podcast, we ask and answer all the questions, don't we, Dane?
Absolutely. No question is too big, too small, too lowbrow, too highbrow. All questions are welcome. And if you do like this show, please rate and review it on Apple Podcasts or follow us on Spotify and you'll never miss an episode. Or you can subscribe to us on Acast, the world's biggest podcast network, where you can hear all the very special questions being asked and answered by our very special guests. On today's show is a sports journalist who has been an expert on African football for more than a decade. He fell in love with football while watching a Roger Miller-inspired Cameroon lose to England in the quarterfinal of the 1990 World Cup. He has a reputation for being one of the best football journalists in the country and is currently a sports writer for The Guardian. He is the host of the podcast and author of Made in Africa, which is all about the history of African players in English football. Pleasure to welcome to the show, Mr. Ed Ahrens.
Hi there, how you doing? Good to be here.
Good, man. You see me, I stumbled a few times to get here, but yeah. That's just a reflection of excitement and also my poor ability to enunciate words.
Ed, what is a piece of artwork that had a big influence on you growing up?
I was just thinking about this as you were asking it before, and I think, I'll have to go for a music one. I think the Fugees album, The Score.
Great choice.
1996.
Really good choice.
It was a really, just thinking back actually when you were over it, had some three massive hits and I think they were all like number one in the top.
Oh yeah.
Top of the charts. But it wasn't just for that. I think it was just the depth of the album. And like,
it was great. It was a really good album. Even down to the skits were amazing and stuff as well.
They were, yeah.
Like, I just always remember Ready or Not, right? And the one that had a line about smoking Sense Amelia, I think it was. And, or smoking something anyway.
Yeah.
And I was like, as a kid, like, wow, like they've got a way of talking about smoking something illegal on Top of the Pops. How cool is that? You know, that's kind of like unbelievable to think in the mid 90s that they could get away with that.
Yeah. What one thing I really liked about it was all the remixes of Fuji La. There's like all these remixes in French and Creole. And I think that's probably the first time I ever heard Creole rap, which is quite mad if you ever heard it before. Basically, we any Wycliffe, Jean. Stuff.
Yeah, I mean, at one point, I was like, Wycliffe is the best rapper out right now. 96, I think he was one of the best. And I think, you know, people forget like how monumental a group that was because, you know, when you think about the solo careers of the other members, like, obviously, Wycliffe Jean went on to do The Carnival and also to be the producer of City High and also to discover Destiny's Child. And Lauryn Hill is Lauryn Hill. And The Miseducation is the one album she made and is still a classic to this day.
Oh, yeah.
And then Praz, well, he didn't really need to work, so he was fine too. and you know that Akon was originally going to become one of the Fugees?
Really?
Was he, isn't it? Is he from...
No, he's not from Haiti, but he's from Senegal, isn't he? But
Yeah,
but we're still, I guess, under the whole refugee camp. Also,
good choice. Very good choice.
He would have fitted in well with him, actually.
Yeah, definitely.
You can hear that.
Here's some other Fugees-based trivia. So one of Wycliffe's other protégés was a guy called John Forte, who did a remix of a song called Stayin' Alive. And he was arrested and imprisoned for drug trafficking and then was pardoned by George Bush Jr.
Nice. That is nice trivia. Great band, great choice, Ed. Very well done. Thanks.
Really good choice.
Dane, it's probably time for a question, isn't it? As the format of this show tends to dictate.
Absolutely. Ed has proved that we can trust him with his good discography and knowledge of music.
It would have been great if he'd said something terrible, no, just for the record.
Well, yeah, that would have been a real curveball.
Like Barbie Girl by Aqua just kind of changed my life.
Oh, yeah, that's absolutely classic. I won't tell you the story about that one, but yeah.
People still play that. There's been a remix of that on social media I've seen as well.
Yeah.
It's a really weird trend.
But I am going to judge people who say that's had a major influence on their life. But anyway, let's go back to the... where were we?
Sorry. That was a pretty suggestive song when you think about it. It was like, you know, you can brush my hair and undress me anywhere.
There was no subtext to that song. I'm sorry.
Quite weird, really.
It was quite weird, yeah, exactly. And the sex doll industry still thrives today. So thank you for that, Aqua.
And they're on the show next week, funnily enough.
Yeah, yeah. So we'll take it up with them then. So it was good. But Ed, as our esteemed guest, we welcome you to ask the first question, which can be any question you'd like, which we'd like to discuss for a quarter of an hour. Then Howard would like to do the same and pose a question back to you for about 15 minutes to discuss. And then in a strange formation and use of tactics, I'm going to ask you a question too, which we discuss for like 15 minutes. And then we'd like you to tell all of our listeners where they can find out more about your good works. How does that sound?
That sounds great. And I've got a good question for you. I hope
let's go.
Like lovely. Let's
bring it. Okay. Like the chat. It's confident.
It's very timely as well, given that the Ballon d'Or took place on Monday evening. At the time of recording, we saw Lionel Messi take his seventh Ballon d'Or. But I just wanted to ask, why has no African player won the Ballon d'Or since George Weah in 1995? In fact, not even that. Why has no African player finished in the top three in the Ballon d'Or standings since George Weah in 1995? In fact, he's the only one. Ever.
And it's worth saying to the listeners who may not be kind of fully football initiated that it's weird that there is this one thing, right, where like, you know, most of you would know, even if you don't follow football, that they want a footballer wants to win the World Cup, the European Championships or the Copa America, which is the equivalent for South America. And then in a domestic game, you want to win your titles. Everyone knows that, right? But then there is this weird thing for a few elite footballers who want to win the Ballon d'Or, which what is it? It's just a thing that says you're the best player in the world, which is, I suppose, quite a brag.
Well, yeah, it's an individual award in a team sport. So it's a bit of a weird one, but yeah, I mean, it's become like the sort of the holy grail if you're a football player. And, you know,
yeah, it's almost like, you know, that certifies that you're going to walk into any punditry job, any brand endorsement job. You know, I mean, I'm sure that it provides leverage on behalf of your agent for you to negotiate wages wherever in the world you go and sells your image likeness for shirts and merchandise. So
how long has it been going for? That's kind of an interesting question because obviously Pele never won it, right? Or Maradona never won it. It wasn't going that long, was it?
I think Pele and Maradona have won it. Yeah, it's been going back since like the 1950s.
Oh, right, I'm talking about.
You have to double check that.
That would be part of the answer to the question there as to why there's not been an African player won it before. If it's been going as long as the 1950s, I would pretty much 1950 up until like 1970.
No, no. Well, the question is, since 1995, when George Weah, yeah, who is obviously, who I don't know if people know, but he's now president of Liberia.
Liberia, yeah.
He's had to kind of go above and beyond, not just being the best player in the world, but also being a humanitarian that contributed towards the end of the Liberian Civil War and then became, president, which is like, outside of football, just as a human being, these are insane achievements. Like, you know, you imagine the paradigm of sitting in a pub and talking with your friends about what you've done with your life. I've been a professional footballer. I've been one of the best footballers in the world and the president of my own country. Like, you never have to buy a drink again, surely.
Yeah, I mean, he has had an unbelievable career. He said, think Arsene
Wenger. It's a life. It's an unbelievable life.
Unbelievable life, yeah. I mean, Arsene Wenger takes a lot of credit for discovering him when he was playing in Cameroon and bringing him to play for Monaco.
Yeah.
And then he went to go on and play for AC Milan and scored an unbelievable goal when he dribbled.
I remember it.
All the length of the
whole
pitch.
Team, all the way from the box at his own half, all the way to the other side.
Yeah, and really, and so he was an absolute icon and still is. But since then, there's been loads of great African players, who've come and gone. Didier Drogba, for example,
definitely should be as a humanitarian and stuff as well.
As well, yeah. I mean, he presented the Ballon d'Or on Monday evening as well, and it was almost like he did it last time as well in 2019 because it was cancelled in 2020. And it's all about, like having an African player who was a great but never got anywhere near winning it. It was kind of like ironic, I thought, that, he's there and, and
essentially being the football equivalent of the bridesmaid and not the bride, which is really strange when you think about Didier Drogba's achievements and, again, his humanitarian work and just how exemplary he's been as a player as well. I mean, definitely know there's a lot of candidates as well that, it's surprising when you think about it. I mean, I pay attention to football, but maybe not focus on Ballon d'Or recipients because the fact Samuel Eto'o's never had one.
No, and he's not even. I think Samuel Eto'o's highest finish was fifth.
Right, that is wild.
Absolutely. And Mohamed Salah is like he came seventh on Monday, and his highest finish is fifth. The only other person in the top five, I think, is Sadio Mane, who came fourth in 2019 and had a brilliant year. But then he wasn't even in the top 30 this year, which probably. Not such a big deal because he didn't have a great year, but Riyad Mahrez was the only other African who was nominated, and he was, he had a pretty good year actually. He had, won the title, top scorer for City, I think, and he was like down in 20th place. So I think it's kind of.
And it's straight. And the thing is, is it your ethnic origin? So, because again, it's like someone like N'Golo Kanté, you'd think. Especially over the last couple of years, would have been considered.
Yeah, he came fourth this time. So I don't know if it. I mean, it's hard to say that it's to do with anything like that because obviously the main issue I suppose you have to talk about is that Lionel Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo have won 12 of the last 13 Ballon d'Ors. Mm. So it's kind of taken out a whole generation of players. But I still think. That there could have been African players, certainly
since 95. Since 95, definitely. I think we've all seen enough. I mean, I remember, and I'm not saying he's necessarily a candidate to consider, but even I remember El Hadj Diouf when he came, when he was discovered, when he was playing against the French football team, and it kind of revolutionized his whole career.
They got to the quarterfinal, a brilliant, absolutely brilliant team. Yeah.
But I think if you're going to name someone who could have got it, and obviously this is a pretty niche for some people who don't follow football that closely, but like Yaya Touré for a period of time was the best player in the world. I think bar none, he scored more goals in midfield than any player at that time, and his team was winning the trophy. So, I think I've got a couple of theories, Ed. Tell me if you think I'm talking bollocks. One of them is obviously there's this kind of staunch loyalty to giving it to Ronaldo and Messi that I do think probably has some elements of kind of, I don't know if I'd say corruption, but there's probably something a bit iffy about the fact that you just keep wanting
to say Messi. Say political. Say something.
Yeah, there you go. Political, because in my head, if you follow football closely, Messi just had one of his worst ever seasons. He won the Copa America. Cool. But let's be honest, like, that isn't the most highly sought after trophy in the world. Like
the views of Howard Cohen regarding
But the world.
Yeah, this is the thing. When you go into bat against either of them, I just tweeted yesterday, for example, it's only because Salah came out seventh and Ronaldo was sick. So I tweeted, I'm not sure what Ronaldo's done to come higher than him. But as some people pointed out, you know, he did finish top scorer in the Euros. And he was top scorer in Serie A. And in Messi's case, he was top scorer in La Liga as well as winning his first international trophy. But I think you're right. I think there is kind of this sort of loyalty to them.
Yeah.
That, like, they get a certain number of votes just because of who they are. Even if they hadn't played all season, they probably
I think there's a lot of people that are involved in the sport. And I'm not necessarily saying they're involved in the panel who very much have bought into the Messi-Ronaldo brand.
Definitely.
And probably aren't as purist in terms of football. And, you know, I think it's, you know, taking into account things like, you know, exponential growth and achievement, depending on where you're from and stuff, is not something they've taken into account, which, you know, again, using N'Golo Kante as an example, I'm like, you know, this is somebody who was playing non-league not too long ago or playing in like the second or third division of the French.
Oh, yeah.
And has had,
he deserves immense respect. But the thing that's interesting about someone like Kante or a number of players that you could flag up is the fact that have more players of an African origin in the past 25 years given allegiance to a major national team of somewhere like France or, you know, potentially other countries? Yeah. And has that limited the amount of people who would have been candidates? I don't know, that might have affected.
Yeah, for example, there's a Karim Benzema, French player, I think came third on Monday, and, you know, he's obviously of Algerian heritage. And then Kante, who's of Malian heritage. So yeah, there were quite a few players like that. But I think
Zinedine Zidane, for that, even that,
well, exactly,
crazy. That's insane. Yeah. And yeah, so I mean, Howard, that's an interesting theory that, you know, maybe it's the national identification that might affect it. But what's the panel composed of, Ed, to make the decision?
That was one thing I was going to say. I think it's mainly journalists from around the world. Okay. So, you know, they're not to be relied on.
Yeah.
As we know.
There are politics that are involved in that. And I'm sure that there are some, in the same way that, so there is, I don't know if it would be the equivalent of the Ballon d'Or, but there's, you know, you have awards for best newcomer and best show at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival for comedians, and it's like the largest arts festival. And what you'll tend to find is that your shortlisted candidates will include a few Australian comics, a few Canadian comics, who have to kind of be in there because it is an international festival, but also the average Edinburgh show costs like $10,000 to put on, including promotion and venue hire, et cetera, and your outgoings. Yeah. So if you have like about 10 or 20 Australian acts, professional acts coming over, vying for this opportunity, they need to be included in the shortlist. Otherwise you think, well, if you haven't got a chance of winning, we're not going to come. And so that would mean the festival will lose 200,000 potential in revenue. So, you know, in terms of journalists, they probably are aware that, you know, Messi's and Ronaldo's and other, I suppose, more European-based players, when they do appear in publications subsequently after getting these nominations and being shortlisted, it's going to help sell more articles to get more clicks and stuff. So they probably feel like if they pick an African footballer, might not generate as much clicks. So
yeah, maybe. Yeah, I think it's what it is. It's one journalist from each, like a designated journalist from each FIFA nation. So it's like sort of 205 or something. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I imagine that some of them are people who don't, you know, they probably all watch football, but some of them just, you know, maybe they support Barcelona or whoever, you know. So it's down to the individual.
But some people might be like, they might rather get like tickets to Nou Camp or Bernabeu rather than going to like watch RB Leipzig Mane came from. Yeah, Mane came from Leipzig, right? Was it Leipzig?
Yeah.
He did, yeah, originally. Yeah.
It's a good question, and I think that it will be interesting to look at it after the era of Messi and Ronaldo ends, what, in the next year or two? That's kind of coming to an end, isn't it?
Is there a continental African equivalent of the Ballon d'Or? Is the African player of the year, right?
Absolutely, yeah. And that's yet to be announced. I think Mahrez won that last time it was awarded, because obviously we've had a year off. But the key thing to say, I think, in this is next year is quite a big one for African football, in that you've got African Nations Cup in January. where obviously a lot of Premier League players are going to be missing for a few weeks. And then obviously the World Cup at the end of the year. So but I think, you know, the Ballon d'Or is probably going to be decided on who wins the World Cup, isn't it? But, you know, if say Mohamed Salah takes Egypt to the title in January, and then Egypt do pretty well in the World Cup, then he's got to have a good chance, you know, with, yeah, say Liverpool do well as well. So, but there's so many different, you know, factors that can influence who's had a good season, because, you know, there's international football and club football, mm-hmm, and European competition as well. So yeah, there's a lot of factors to take in.
There is a lot to take in. And I wonder if after Messi and Ronaldo, they'll start to think over what the criteria is and maybe, I don't know, make it more of a kind of public spectacle. Like, because in the NBA and other American sports, the MVP gets voted for largely by the public for a period of time, if I'm not mistaken. And then I think it goes to a panel after that, doesn't it?
I think so, yeah. I mean, it's quite, I don't know if you saw any of it last night, but it's quite a glitzy occasion. And it was, it's interesting to see, I always find it interesting seeing Messi in that environment, because he's, you know, not exactly the most extroverted person, even though he's an absolute like superstar. Yeah. He always gets dressed up with his wearing a sequin jacket. And it's quite a sort of glitzy affair.
Yeah.
But it's very French, because it's obviously run by France football. But yeah, I think
could be made. When you put it that way, Ed, that could be part of the answer to the question. You know, I mean, obviously being that a large part of the North African nations are former French colonies, and then you do have a number of pay francophones, which would include places like Mali and Zanzibar and called the Ivory Coast. Could be part of the politics there. That maybe if they were to have more African players, might lead to a decentralization of power or a lack of emphasis on African players becoming transplants to the French leagues and maybe contributing to the French football. Maybe if they knew they could still realize their profiles from Ballon d'Or by remaining in Africa.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why United Healthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Could maybe people be less inclined to support French football?
Maybe. Well, Samuel Eto'o's, this is something I wrote about in my book, just at the long, I think it was at the 2018 one, that Samuel Eto'o was really questioning why African players did so badly, because it was the year that Salah and Mane were just tearing up for Liverpool. Mm-hmm. And he's been quite outspoken on this subject before, as has Edouard Mendy as well, the Chelsea keeper, who's questioned why he hasn't been, you know, included in certain things and why he missed out as well as the best keeper of the year to Donnarumma. But that's a tough one, I think.
Yeah, it's a good question, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. We'll maybe get you back next year, Ed, and we can talk about what the latest result was. It'll probably just be Ronaldo again, I guess. But
it's going to be like nearly 40 by then. But yeah, you never know. I'm sure he'll still come in the top five or top 10.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. He'll definitely work on that. So,
my question this week, following on from yours, we're going to keep it a football theme show for so far, unless Dane wants to diverge later. But I've got a question that's broad about football, and I think about it a lot, which is diving, right? Anyone who doesn't watch any football ever.
Simulation.
Howard. Simulation. Players often can be seen to be what people would consider play acting or like faking injury for the purposes of gaining an advantage. That could be an advantage for their team it's always an advantage for their team, but like, it's also partly kind of trying to get players sent off, I guess, or bookings or foul, however you want to term diving. That's what we're looking at. And my question is, are they always trying to cheat, or Is there like a mental illness potentially that that comes with playing football, right? And I say that because I genuinely think that these people, they cannot be, they're not stupid, right? So they know that we know that they're not injured, right? But I can't help but think there is like a mental problem with some of these footballers where they are so primed about not getting injured and are so kind of on edge and psychologically kind of just fragile that's why they put that they act the way they act. What do you reckon, Ed? Am I talking bollocks?
Well, I think no. I sadly, I'm a bit more cynical, and I think it's more to do with them just trying to get as much advantage as they can from whatever situation. And I think, I don't know if you guys have seen this, but from the other day in the Copa Libertadores.
Amazing final, clip. What amazing
which
clip.
Was the fight. It's like the Champions League final in South America. And it was, he's got a great name for it as well. It's the perfect name, Davison from Palmeiras. And he, and the clip shows him just walking along. The referee places his hand on his back just to check he's all right. And then he dramatically dives to the floor and
thinking it's an opponent
exactly. it is just outrageous. And I think it sums up exactly what these players are, what they're trying to do. Really, it's just trying to cheat. I think we can use that word.
Yeah,
gamesmanship or whatever you want to say. But yeah, it's really just cheating.
I definitely think there's a percentage of them that are doing that. But if you indulge me for a bit long, I think there's this percentage of players, right? Because football is the only game, and you know, tell me if I'm wrong. I'm all happy to be proven wrong. Football is the only game where the predominant part of your body that you play it with is your feet and your legs, right? Like, you know, comparative sports would be like rugby. Obviously, it's hands. You kick, I know, in rugby, but it's like more about hands and upper body, right? You know, you could look at basketball. It's once again, like you use your legs, right? But you know, you're controlling the ball with your hands. I could go on with this, tennis, you know. Blah, blah. It's pretty much the only sport where you're controlling the ball with your feet, right?
It's mainly football and tackle.
Sure, so of the major sports, yeah, football's the only one where you can try. And I think, foot golf, yeah, still waiting for that to become big. But like, if you think about it like that, right, so this is the only sport where you control the ball with your feet. And the fact is, like, that is incredibly fucking hard. Now, that's not to say that Roger Federer or Itoje or LeBron, they're all amazing at what they do in their individual sports, but there is something we're better with our hands. I admit it. Like the amount of things you can get your hands to do compared to what you can get your feet to do, it's incredibly clear that we're better with our hands, right? So football is this incredible thing. It's like a miracle. Really, is a miracle that these people can control this thing at the level they can. And I think that has sent some of them to a point where they are so uptight about getting injured, and it's about so uptight about, I think they go onto the pitch and they are like made of glass waiting to, they're just so desperate. Because if I ran towards you now, Ed, and tried to kick you in the leg, right, you'd freak the fuck out, right?
I'd sidestep you. Or try to, anyway.
Should the ball just completely evade it totally?
But if your job was
I was just going to say, it's quite helpful. I was just walking my dog, and you always get these like little dogs flying at you, like especially you've got the treats out for the dog. And you get quite good at moving out of the way. Like one just came at me before; it was about to hit me in the leg, and I just swiveled out of the way, and it just went flying. But I know what you mean. They are quite highly strung individuals, footballers.
Like, if you were going to get kicked, your job was going to be, I'm going to get kicked. You'd do everything you can to not get kicked, right?
Yeah, I think so. Although, I don't know, if you were a player, it wouldn't be too bad being injured because you've got all these lovely facilities to recuperate and still get paid.
But it's getting there, though, because I think a large part of the footballer's journey is the, you know, getting through academy or, you know, basically, obviously, the gulf between maybe being discovered as a footballer and getting to the point where you sign either a YTS or sign a professional contract, the risk of injury ending your career is quite abundant for a footballer. So I guess it could be that. I was watching something recently where it's like, there's a reason why people have never tried to domesticate zebras is because zebras are really high strung and they're really anxious and confrontational because lions eat them. If you know your lion food, you're going to be on edge as a person. And when you consider footballers, the odds of becoming a footballer for everyone playing professional football in England alone is 0.03%. And everyone has a story of someone we know who had some athletic promise and that ended due to injury. You can imagine why people have become so paranoid, because especially like in South America, because, and Ed, you can correct me on this or give your volunteer opinion as well, you as well, Howard. Like, as good as Lionel Messi is, had he begun his career at a time where football wasn't as stringent about injuries and tackles, particularly in Europe, he may not have, at his height, without like and without any potential growth hormone, he may not have been able to reach the levels he would have been able he reached. Whereas when you look at somebody like Ronaldo, as in Brazilian Ronaldo, number nine, like injuries marred his career for a very long time. Yeah. And I think if he had come up in an environment where football was equally as stringent as it is now, he may not have suffered as many injuries. The same as
definitely possible.
Who's the other?
Yeah, it's true. I mean,
he played for West, if you look at, West Ham player as well, who got injured as well. Jamie Redknapp as well. Like a few, like really amazing, promising players have had their careers kind of stalled due to injury. Some have recovered, but like someone like Aaron Ramsey as well, like when Shawcross snapped his leg.
But that's what I mean. Can you? There you go. Let's take Aaron Ramsey. This is a footballer who had the most horrific leg injury anyone ever saw on a football pitch.
Not the most horrific one. It was what's his face? The dude,
David Brazilian. Boost. Oh.
Was it, yeah, Eduardo.
The rest of his career, the idea that
would be like, come near me at any point, I'm ready to fucking roll on the floor and cry because I'm so scared of being injured.
Yeah, but I always remember the David Boost one for Coventry and Peter Schmeichel against Man United. It was a long time ago, but when Peter Schmeichel needed counselling because it was so horrible. Yeah. You can understand it, like you say. I mean, their whole career is very flimsy, isn't it? And it's based on each contract you get is basically, you know, it's a guarantee for those number of years. But if you're injured after that, and then that could be it. But yeah, I think most players are very very cautious about it. But at the same time, you know that they're probably quite durable as well because they're, you know, they've had to put their bodies through quite a bit to get, like you say, to get where they are.
I'll tell you this, like I went to school with Sean Wright Phillips, who is alongside, it's him and Aaron Lennon were the two of the shortest players that ever played in the Premier League. But I can tell you for free, like easily one of the strongest people I'd met in my life in school, one of the most resilient athletes ever. And so, like I said, the level of strength and conditioning that is required to play football at pace, I think a lot of time to us, it looks like players are simulating and they're diving or they're being maybe appearing to be overly sensitive to protect themselves. But I think when you consider the pace that Premier League football or football in general is played at and, you know, the athleticism that's involved, the opportunity for injury is a lot more abundant than we think it is, especially if you're colliding with people at speed. And even just like, just the general grueling of, you know, doing fast twitch muscle exercises up and down a hectare of a pitch can predispose you to quite serious injury anyway. So it's like, I guess the way sometimes how what would look like a normal trip that would make someone stumble slightly, when you're running at a certain pace, that can lead to like ruptures of ligaments or twists and damages and very slight fractures. And so
you definitely affects your mental health, right?
Yeah, the anxiety that comes from that.
Yeah, it's interesting. We're talking about this on the podcast also about Wilfried Zaha, who's the most fouled player in the Premier League this season and usually is most seasons. He plays for not the best team either, Crystal Palace, but he is the player that, you know, leads their attacks. And
definitely the talisman player there.
He's definitely the talisman. And he was saying to a colleague of mine, Adrian Kajumba, on the podcast that he's got a scar. You know, he's got all these scars on it on his legs, which he can remember, like which opponent that inflicted it on him. And he's got this, you know, he's sort of the pantomime villain for all the opposition fans as well, who always accuse him of going down too easily. Yeah. But I think it's really hard to, you know, to understand what actually it's like being out there unless you go to matches, in which case you can see it and hear it because, you know, when there's a foul committed, it's like it's pretty obvious, you know, and the like, especially on like a cold winter's day when you know, you've been knocked over and you're having, you know, you've got no breath left. It's quite a tough situation to be in.
But particularly when you look at it, like, I'll take a player like Phil Foden, this beautiful, beautiful footballer who's you know, England are going to hopefully have for a decade plus, donning it in our, you know, our national team at tournaments. And, you know, he's pretty well put together, but he's still a very slight, smallish guy, particularly in comparison to some of the giant beasts that he's taking, you know, he's facing on the pitch, you know. So the idea that Phil Foden, when he gets tackled by, like, let's say Van Dijk as a great example of an amazing, like roaring animal, like such a powerful creature on the pitch. Like, if the idea that he would be like, oh, fuck, like, I've just been tackled by Van Dijk and it hurt a bit, but I'm actually just really worried when I come near him that he's going to hit me. I think that's, we make such fun of them. And that case of the other day with the guy rolling around with the referee tapped him, he's like, there's loads of examples of when you can find it being like extreme examples of cheating badly. And they're bad at it, right? They're terrible at it.
It's quite a cultural thing though, isn't it? Because like what in some South American leagues, if you fall down, it makes sense. And that's part of the performance as well. Whereas like, you know, in the Premier League, if you fall and it's perceived that you are simulating, that can slightly mar your career for a very long time. Like, look, I remember how long people were fucking with Ashley Young when they said that he dives.
Yeah, that did go on for a while.
For a long time.
He did quite a few times, to be fair. I remember one against Crystal Palace.
The remedy? What's the remedy for this then, Ed?
I think they should be a bit tougher on booking people for diving. Although, as I said, it is quite hard to say, it is quite hard for the referee to make that split second decision.
Well,
that is the way.
VAR is, I guess VAR is, sounds like what you're asking for is VAR, Howard. And while VAR is very useful, I can definitely see a contingent of football fans who become very frustrated at the additional administration and the more NFL style of deliberation that's now needed with VAR. So there's probably a very accurate way of capturing motion and seeing if someone is simulating or not. But then it's up to us if we want football to be a game of two halves that involves athletes trying to score a goal, or we don't want it to be a very drawn out, you know, meticulously observed process where your average football game, like a Ford's or a Super Sunday game, now becomes like a Super Bowl game, where instead of like the whole together altogether being like maybe 2 hours, becomes like a whole 8 hour affair. So
maybe. Yeah, there's no need for that. I think just referees, if they think someone's dived, then they should give him a yellow card.
Yeah.
And then it could always be overturned at a later date if necessary. But yeah, it's just that it needs to be discouraged, really, isn't it?
Because maybe there's a campaign we can do it where it's like, you think diving's bad? Well, racism is like a diver doing it 10 times over. Most racists are also divers, and then and that would change it. Yeah, most racists are divers, and they take more than one orange at half time. Do you want to be a racist or a diver? Of course you don't. Football.
Well, yeah. Dane's come up with a solution, which is really good.
This is a campaign.
The diving.
Let's do it.
Okay, well, it started here, guys.
It's jumpers for goalposts. Not goggles, just swimming. Don't dive, you prick.
And just to reference something that came up, I think, a long time ago on a podcast with one guest, which was the fact that I predicted that there would be no linesmen anymore and that we'd just replace them with robots. And it actually, they're testing that out next year. So that's something to look forward to. No more linesmen. Do you see that news? I thought it was quite entertaining seeing they're going to be 12 points of data,
Howard,
on cameras.
Those linesmen have families. They have families that they have to support as well. Now, yeah. I know a lot of football fans would argue they don't deserve families, but they have them anyway. Okay.
Well, this is an interesting question because this, not just in football, but this is going to be something that's going to happen quite a lot in various jobs, isn't it, in the future? I think they're going to become automated.
When smart pitches come along, you know, that can detect motion, they can detect, like, you know, they might be able to detect through facial recognition grimaces if people meant that kind of thing and stuff as well. So,
is there
a smart pitch already, Ed? You know, I'm sure, because I imagine with the whole automated linesman and like with the VAR for like goal line technology, I'm sure somebody's probably working on, if there doesn't exist already, like a smart pitch, which can also cover like the amount of, you know, kilometers that people travel and stuff like that, and have the whole.
Yeah, well, there's already, my friend was telling me there's already like a basic camera you can buy that you set up next to the pitch if you want to watch your kids play or, you know, training. And it'll give you all these stats afterwards, like, you know, kilometers run and various things.
It's already happening.
Yeah, it's real. But no, in just in terms of not just in football, but in loads of different industries, certain jobs might, you know, be taken over by robots pretty soon. And yeah, you know, like driverless cars and things like that. I wonder.
Not it's journalists, like, no, you're safe.
No, well, there's the Scoopmeister 2000 that's been in been in development for a few years now. So
sounds great.
Yeah, no, there is. I think there is already automated journalism as well. So sadly,
yeah. Dane, it's over to you. My question is slightly mental, that one, isn't it? But I just find it. People get so upset about the divers, so that's why I thought I'd throw it in if they side with them for once. But it's over to you, mate, for the final question of today's football frenzied podcast.
Well, I'd like to keep the tactics straight and direct. They've been effective so far. Mm. Obviously, expertise is in chron. I remember that game, by the way, in Cameroon versus England in 1990. Very inspirational game. So yeah, I can definitely understand why that would have been a catalyst for a very successful career in journalism, football journalism, particularly emphasis on African players. With that being said, I'd just like to happily prick your brain about it. Could you give me your timeless African 11, including free subs, and it could be from any period, from the World Cup 1990?
What players from that? Just from that?
No. From since that tournament.
Oh right. Okay.
Or your African 11 plus three subs.
Okay. Mm. Well, I'm with
explanation, obviously, as to why.
I definitely will start with somebody who I've been very excited with this season, goalkeeper, and it's a modern player because there haven't been that many amazing African keepers. If you go, a few Cameroonian players, but.
Why do you think that is?
He was from Trinidad.
Oh,
He used to play cricket with the Brian Lara, actually. Oh, he used to bowl to Brian Lara. Yeah, but yeah, it's an interesting question, actually. Yeah, I'm not sure. I think it's a lot to do with it's the sort of loss, distrust, maybe, yeah, a little
it's
bit.
It's also like it's culturally, when you consider that like football can be used as a springboard into a better life for your family. And I think among communities within the diaspora, being in goal when that's taking place is not seen as particularly glamorous or predisposing you to stand out. Like a lot of the time where people can use things like African Cup of Nations as a showcase, then I think, and also I guess historically in football, like black players have been advised due to placing athleticism to players wingers or wing backs, winger forwards, and so yeah.
It's interesting though because in my book I talk about Arthur Wharton, who is the first African player to play in English football in the 19th century, and he was actually a goalkeeper.
Oh.
So yeah, it kind of it's a funny one that it's he almost played for England. He was sort of on the edges of doing that, but then ended up also played cricket and was a 100 yards world champion. So it's quite an all-round sportsman.
Yeah, nice
from,
one.
From Ghana.
We need more all-round sportsmen. There needs to be more all-round sportsmen games.
Yeah.
Like people like that, or like, remember like Bo Jackson, who was like the baseballer
Michael Jordan did a...
Michael Jordan did baseball as well.
Yeah.
Allen Iverson was an NFL player as well.
Yeah.
Apparently Odell Beckham Jr. is a decent soccer player or football player as well as playing NFL.
It makes sense because a lot of, if you're good at one sport, you know, hand-eye coordination and stuff like that. It tends
a lot of footballers are good golfers as well. They're decent. I think Jermaine Defoe is like a decent golfer and stuff as well. So
they've got a lot of time to spend on the course, haven't they?
Yeah, exactly.
No, obviously. But defenders, I would definitely have to. The first one I wanted to talk about was Lucas Radebe from Leeds in South Africa.
Great character.
Amazing character. Just amazing man. I don't know if you guys know, but he was shot when he was a teenager.
Mm.
Lived in Soweto outside Johannesburg. And got in the way of a bullet, basically, between some gangs. Before he came to England and, made his name at Leeds. And he's still an absolute legend up there. And just a little fact about in Leeds when he retired, he was captain around 2003. I think Lucas was the most popular boy's name in Leeds.
That's cool.
He's such an icon and still is, I think, to all the Leeds.
That's a great centre back. That's a great centre back.
Yeah, and I think just sort of for somebody a bit bit more zany, I don't know if people remember Taribo West.
Oh, I'm so pleased you said Taribo West.
Great choice.
Probably not the second best African defender in the Premier League, but he had great hair.
And he became
a pastor.
That was going to be one of my questions as well, because like there's a very it's a very unique thing about African players, was about the hairstyles and being able to stand out and distinguish yourselves, particularly in computer console adaptations of football games. And I always remember Teribo West standing out in International Superstar Soccer Deluxe.
Oh, yeah.
With a different hair.
Oh, yeah, he was good in that. So we've got Teribo West.
A separate podcast on the expression of African identity through the hair in football is a whole...
Oh, yeah.
There's a documentary there that deserves a little mini documentary there.
But Teribo West and Radebe is a great start in the defence. Mendy behind them.
Yeah, fullbacks. I was just thinking, definitely Lauren. The Arsenal, former Arsenal.
Underrated, right?
He was part of the Invincibles team, wasn't he?
That's the only reason why he would be underrated, because at the time, like, you know, it was Invincible, so...
And he could also play, in centre mid. So I think he was probably one of the first, if you look now, actually, looking back, he was kind of how the fullback's role was changed from being, like we were saying yesterday, like one of the last people on the team sheet. To now being one of the, like, probably the first, you know, most important. He was very important for Arsenal's attacking play, as well as being a good defender. And then I was just trying to think of a left back, and I think it's not that many who've done that well. Celestine Babiaro, from Chelsea.
Great, good
to talk. I'm sure it'll come to me later and it'll annoy me, but I can't think of any other.
I don't think there is.
Emmanuel Boué is a right back, isn't he?
Emmanuel Boué, right back, yeah. We could play him there.
Yeah, or Lassana Diarra.
Centre mid.
I'm going to show my football geekiness, Ed, and tell you who it could be. It could be a guy who had an absolute kind of rocket of a left foot, which is a Cameroon left back called Pierre Wome. Do you remember him?
I actually thought of him. Yeah. I do. He played for Fulham. He played or Asuakotu as well. Asuakotu.
Great choice.
A man who didn't like football.
Yeah, that's right. He didn't like great football. Choice. And that was true. He didn't. He genuinely didn't.
I'm sure, there's a few footballers like that, I'm sure, that are just like, it's a job.
Yeah, I think Ben White said the other day, the Arsenal defender said recently that he didn't watch any football or anything like that. So, you'd have thought you'd want to have some interest in it, but I can understand it. Your whole life is devoted to it. Every day you want to get away from it, I suppose.
Yeah, there's people, because when it's a job to you, then you want an outside hobby.
It is important. I mean, it is nice. I like getting away from just, you know, work, just having a couple of days, just like not listening to the radio or anything like that.
That's fair enough. So it's a good defence, Ed. Okay, so we're solid back four and a goalkeeper. It's going to explode in midfield, I imagine.
The midfield. I've just got a ridiculous amount.
Are you going with a 4-4-2 formation as well?
Yeah, I think I will, but I'll probably just put two wide player. But the centre mid is definitely. Michael Essien. Who I actually had the pleasure of interviewing with for my book. And it's a good little story about him, just that it was a soccer aid thing at Stamford Bridge. And Didier Drogba was there and it obviously was commanding a lot of attention. And I just looked around and like sitting in the stand was like Michael Essien. No one was paying him any attention whatsoever. And it's like people maybe forget about how good he was.
He was so good.
He was actually the first African player to win Chelsea's Player of the Year ahead of Drogba. That's how good he was. He was like he made an instant impact when he came from Lyon. For a couple of years was one of the players you probably should have been top three Ballon d'Or.
Irreplaceable for a long time ever at Chelsea as well. And didn't he go to Real Madrid after Chelsea went to Real Madrid?
I think he played a lot when he was younger and just things caught up with him.
Really versatile player as well. Really versatile in terms of positionally. He's a box-to-box midfielder as well, wasn't he?
He was, yeah. He was absolutely fantastic. And I'm just trying to think who to play alongside him. I could cheat and have either Claude Makélélé or Patrick Vieira.
I think you can cheat. Listen, this is a...
Can I cheat?
I want to see Toure. I want to see Yaya Toure next to Michael Essien.
He's got subs,
that's
Howard.
True. Yeah, let's have Toure in there. But just to point out that both of those two, who were, you know, two of the best players ever, Makélélé had a position named after him. Vieira is just... Arsenal and French legend. They're both born in Africa. Yeah, he's doing very well, Crystal. I'm very impressed with Vieira. He's an interesting man, actually. He's very softly spoken, sort of has an aura about him.
So
Yaya Toure has to be the
Howard, I prefer I like the hypothetical African one. You can do whoever you want, Ed. It's your team.
Yeah.
No, but he is right though. He has to be Toure and Essien really in the middle there.
Toure and Essien is a killer combo.
But we'll do Makalele in brackets
and
as well.
I'm assuming I know who the third member of the African midfield is, but maybe I'm going to be proven wrong. But
well, I think I might do 4-4-2. So either this is going to allow me to put. I mean, I'm going to play Salah on the right though because he plays on the right for Liverpool, and Mane on
Salah
the left.
In there. Yeah.
Mane on the left.
Nice.
And that's going to let me get
deadly.
It's probably not the best defensive.
No. But
it's going to let me get, obviously, Didier Drogba in there as a striker. And I'm just going to have a cheeky one of my own as well. I'll play him up front. But I don't know if people remember him, but he's probably my favourite African player. This is hard, actually. I was going to say there, I was going to say Peter Ndav.
But
he's more of a winger. And I've also got Tony Yeboah, who was...
What a legend.
Tony Yeboah.
What a legend.
And I'm sure I've missed out Mahrez too.
So. Well, you've missed out a few people. Just to name, a couple might be Samuel Eto'o, George Weah. Roger Miller would have been another one.
He didn't play
one.
In the Premier League. Though,
oh, Miller. Right, okay.
No, those two weren't at their peak either as well, obviously.
That's true.
Yeah.
I think you've got to chuck Kanu really into the mix, haven't you? Kanu is one of the all-time crazy players, right?
This is really tough. I've had to try and do this before. I mean, but at least you gave me a team rather than.
But the one that we've got to talk about surely is JJ, no? JJ Okocha. That's why I thought you were going to.
Legend.
Yeah, I thought if you were putting him in the midfield with Essien and Toure, you've got like this killer trio, right? And then you play Mane, Salah, and you play one of Drogba.
Play Drogba as the main striker.
That front four is absolutely...
With JJ in the hole.
JJ in the hole. That's
JJ
really
in the hole with Mane, Salah, Drogba, and behind him is Toure.
Yeboah and Love on the bench.
Yeah, that's fair. And Kolo Toure, because everyone needs Kolo Toure, obviously, because he's, just good for morale, as well as being, at one point, a very good player. But I think people have just kept him around for morale reasons, haven't they? He was just a popular guy, isn't he, Kolo Toure?
Kolo Toure, well, actually, interesting character because he a very good player in his day. It went wrong quite quickly for him after he went to City. But now he's doing really good stuff as a coach, apparently.
Yeah.
He's assistant to Brendan Rodgers. And
he's a popular dude, isn't he? He's like a likeable guy. And that's interesting to see that going quite far for someone,
Definitely. Right. No, I think he could be quite an important pioneer for African coaches as well. We'll see how he gets on in his career.
And that's what kind of we want. I did want to ask, actually, Ed, I know we don't have time, but I wanted to ask you as well about we had the earlier discussion about this Super League earlier in the year. Do you think that an African Super League would help the continent to raise its profile and, maybe draw more attention to football there? Because I think, what team is it recently I saw? There's been a team that's been bought by billionaires that Alex Song plays for.
Oh, no, Djibouti.
Djibouti, that's it. Yeah,
wow.
The North.
Oh, I've not heard about that, actually.
So.
It's interesting because the problem with African football at the moment is that FIFA, I have to say this, is on a bit of a power grab.
Mm.
They've just installed Patrice Motsepe, who is a South African mining millionaire who owns Mamelodi Sundowns in South Africa, which is like a big club over there. It's a big power grab going on at the moment. And then FIFA are trying to push through this Champions League idea, or Super League, for the whole continent, which in theory sounds like quite a good idea, I think, because it could attract a bit more sponsorship and stuff like that. But whether it fits into the whole global calendar and it's kind of part of the whole plan to have the World Cup every 2 years, so I'm a bit loath to say whether it's a good idea at the moment. It's just being sort of forced through at the moment with the promise of more cash and stuff like that. But
it's just interesting for me. It's could Africa be an opportunity for footballers who don't necessarily realise their aspirations over here? Could they go play in the African leagues? And in the way that there's now the NBA Now I have like an African league where which Obama is involved with as well, and J. Cole was apparently going to play in. So, you know, is there the opportunity for players who are of African origin to maybe go and play in the continent and maybe still have a career?
Maybe, yeah. It's something they definitely need to work on, because at the moment it's not, you know, there are some lucrative leagues in Africa, but like
it's not everywhere.
No, I mean, there's only like it's a couple really, like South Africa, you can get a decent amount, and in Egypt.
Because I always think it's like you want a situation whereby, you know, we're not losing out on another Togolese player that could be the next Adebayor or the next Kante that's from Mali, but they don't have the league is not as strong as like a league would be in South Africa or Nigeria, for example. So
this is a big issue for African football. Yeah, I mean, there's certain countries that have got a good system of getting players into Europe, but I mean, it's getting younger and younger. Actually, obviously, there's like limits on how young players can go, but. Yeah, certain countries, like I did something about Zambia. There's a couple of players who came to the Premier League. This guy called Lee Kawanu, who went on the podcast on episode 2, talks about how he's set up this pathway to enable players who are really from, like, there's such remote places in Zambia. Yeah. As he said to me, like, most people don't even know where Zambia is. And that's the first thing I have to tell them, like, you know, where it is and point to it on a map. And he's managed to get a pathway. He's got two players, multi-million pound moves to Leicester, Patson Daka and Enoch Mwepu from who's at Brighton. So it just shows you that there is a possibility if you create that pathway and can try and help set it up anyway.
What a good football full episode of Questions Everything, Dane. We've questioned a lot of football based stuff today. It's been pretty good, Ryan.
No, it's been very enjoyable. Thank you for coming on the show, Ed. Please continue your good work. Make an emphasis on highlighting all of the talent abundant on the continent. For those that want to find out more, where can I hear about more of your good work, sir?
Yeah, thanks a lot, guys. It's been an absolute pleasure to chat with you. As we were talking about before, I'm doing the Made in Africa podcast with my colleague, Rahman Osman, who's from London World. And you can read me in The Guardian most weeks. Do something for them. And also I've written the book Made in Africa, the history of African players in English football, which has been out for a couple of years now, but is available still in all good bookshops. So please, if you have some time, go and check it out.
I will. I definitely will. Looking forward to it. I hope there's illustrations with hair in there, Ed. African footballer hair is like
there definitely is. Oh, there's some amazing pictures in there. I have to say, actually, that was a real pleasure of doing the book. It was trying to find them. It was quite tough.
Oh, of course. It's hard to choose. Got El Hadj Diouf for some Jibril Cissé moves in there. So yeah, I definitely will be checking it out, man. So
good stuff. Thank you very much.
Absolute pleasure, man.
Thanks for coming on the show.
Cheers, guys.
You've been listening to Dane Baptiste Questions Everything, hosted by Dane Baptiste. For more from Dane, go to danebaptiste.co.uk or follow him on Twitter at DaneBapTweets or Instagram at DaneSnapTeast. Our guest was Ed Ahrens. You can follow Ed on Twitter at Ed_Ahrens. The show is produced by me, Howard Cohen. Follow me on Twitter and Instagram at TheHowardCohen. The show is mixed and mastered by Audio Culture. You can follow Audio Culture on Instagram at WeAreAudioCulture. Please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to us. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at DBQE Podcast. Thanks for listening, guys. And remember, question everything.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.